All right, we're back to the second half of the lecture. And I see, as often happens, that we've sort of covered this slide already where we were going in our discussion earlier about how we've become abstracted from playing music in our modern world. And it's become a professional's job. And I tried playing a bit of music when I was a teenager, and it's disheartening. It's disheartening. You know, even you don't forget the guys that, you know, on the stage. I'm there in my little bedroom, you know, ding de pling, and you know, somebody turns up and they can do it all, and you just think, oh, you know, what's the point? You know, it's and there's a whole thing, I guess, with musicians, with all artistic expression, that people are very sensitive as well about how good they are and all of that, you know, and how that there's a competitive element in a way. At the same time, when it works, that people put that aside, you know, when a group of people start really playing music, then that's all put aside and the music becomes the thing. But it can easily fracture into these individuals who are worrying about what other people are thinking of them. And you do make yourself very vulnerable as well when you sing or play a musical instrument. It's almost like I was saying, if somebody doesn't like that, it's almost like that, I don't like you. Do you know, it goes quite deep. But we've...
take the piss out of you, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
It's been seen to be ridiculous. That's the problem.
Yes. Yes, but I did have an opportunity in my former life, which I don't know if we discussed my former life, when I was involved with Sannyas and being a kind of a what we would call a cult member now, but there was a lot of music there, and you know, you'd get together every Sunday and there'd be a kind of meditation with music, and then there'd be kind of dancing, singing, you know, all and the whole it wasn't whether are you any good or not, but can anyone here play anything? Do you know that kind of? Can you play anything? If you can't play anything, then sing. Do you know? But basically, it was the whole coming together musically. Although, you know, Nicolette didn't enjoy it as much as me. It was a window back into a former way of being together. And of course, what you're playing is it just doesn't compare to the recorded music. If you get anywhere near playing a musical instrument, or singing, and you realise how extraordinary those finished products are. I know a lot of it's been done digitally now as well, but you can't really compete with them. You know, we're overawed by our musical technology now, and the fact that it's playing all the time. You know, you're in the car, press a button. You know, it's continuously available. It's not a special event that only occurs when you're with the people who do the singing and playing. This was in my 20s, right, a long time ago, but I guess I look back on it now and I think that was a genuinely good way of being together. Why don't we do it more? Why don't we do it more? Why don't we make a space? I mean, I guess in the old days, I mean, it was the congregation, wasn't it? Every Sunday, you'd be singing your hymns. Mm-hmm. I mean, but that just turned into such a... I don't know about where you were, but that was just such a dreadful bore. Mm-hmm. You know, hymn number 363. You know, carols. Carols have got a little bit of it still, haven't they?
They've got mystic things.
Yeah,
well.
They've still got a little... Carols at Christmas, Christmas carols.
And African people with their...
Yeah, gospel music.
Now we're...
Yes. So this slide was just saying to that, there's still Glastonbury, you know, there's still a little bit of something like that going on in the country. That sense of a different way of being together, where it's the being together, and we were discussing the football matches, although there's a certain kind of warrior aspect to that that's... not there at Glastonbury, I assume. I assume. I haven't been to a festival for a long time.
Only when they played the World Cup on the pyramid screen.
Oh, that.
Yeah.
That's
but it was a different. It was very different. Yeah, it was taken very differently.
Yes.
Excuse my still eating.
Yeah, no, that's. Carry on. He's just emphasising the binding together that music achieves with a group of people. It's been kind of removed from our public domain, more or less. But we're deluged with music now. You know, I find it oppressive, shopping now.
It seems like the music's not touching anymore. It's kind of made in I think there was something that you can create a song so it becomes catchy enough for us and so many people to buy it. And so it's made by a formula and is not sort of maybe come from a person's within. It's not created from a within, but from a, okay, right, we do this, this and that, put that together and boom.
Yeah.
There's so much of it out there that
yes.
Maybe we're also getting desensitized.
Mm. Well, I was doing a lot of decorating, and somewhere I was programmed into me. When you do decorating, John, you play the radio.
Yeah.
So I'm Radio 2 because I'm of a certain age, you know.
My father's a painter decorator.
Yeah.
And Radio 2 every day.
Yeah.
The
Radio
last 35 years.
Yeah. It used to be Radio 1, but Radio 1's become Radio 2 for people of my age.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the stream, you know, of what's played on there, and yet every now and then something emerges. I'll find out there's a piece of music there where what you're talking about, there's something very subtle, isn't there, where there's something in a piece of music where you can kind of feel that it's come from somewhere else.
And perhaps also a vulnerability, and perhaps that vulnerability of the artist touches your vulnerability, because they're exposing a vulnerability in a way, and they're sharing something that they really create.
Yes, because there's a big stream of formula,
mm-hmm.
and there's a sense, you know, I'm talking back to, I was born in the last day, you know, virtually of the 1950s, but the entire music industry of the 1950s was a business. You know, you hire your songwriters, you get your singer, you know, you get your producer, you get it together, you turn the formula, and out comes a record. And there's a sense now in the music that I'm seeing largely that model's back in place. It's the music industry that's just cranking the handle, right? Picking somebody who looks right, sticking them the songs and chucking them out. So that's back in place. But there's always the exception, you know, every now and then.
There's lots of really unusual music that you can listen to now because
wouldn't be on Radio 2, would it?
So people don't know that people, you know, they earn money by touring, and there's my favourite musician I found on Spotify, and she has a limited appeal.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Yes.
But isn't it the need or the expectation to hear emotional authenticity that can make performing embarrassing? And wouldn't it be the case that maybe at this time that music making would be more formulaic in that there would be a set structure decided by the social group?
Yeah.
The type of music you'd sing, and so you wouldn't really have to give, you wouldn't be exposing part of yourself through performance. So you're so liberated in that way to just sing.
Yes.
So you know, be judged on the emotional content or authentic you are, and so you're not, you know, on that level of judgment.
Yes, but you know, there's something when you play music together that every now and then, something else happens. If you really there's sort of an absence of self consciousness in that everyone who's playing, you get so absorbed in the music, and then the music, you can start to become collectively creative as well. Where it's no longer "oh, you did it,"
mm-hmm.
you know. There's a "we did it" that can occur. That's quite extraordinary. You know, it's still available to us even in our, you know, our fallen state. You know that we still have kind of links back to this capacity to sing and dance. You know.
And maybe that's also a little aspect of empathy. So when you hear the lyrics, or if you if you have sounds that are kind of, you know, sort of sad sounds, maybe that touches our, you know, our empathy. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I mean, I was kept alive by music at a certain point in my life when I got extremely isolated when I was at university, first time. And there was something in, for me it was Van Morrison. There was something in Van Morrison that said, "It's all right, John. There's another world. There's another world, John. You know, I'm singing from there. You know, so there's extraordinary music can communicate, and it doesn't say there's another world, John. Although he was singing, I've got a home on high. You know, but." But it wasn't. I mean, I listened to Van later, and I realized, you know, he's singing from there's something around about here. When he's actually producing it, it's coming from something that's, you know, further down.
It's the rhythm of it, though, isn't it? Yeah, even that album, Astral Weeks Over, is about do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, and it's so uplifting, and it's not like anything else. It makes a feeling that you have. Where does it come from? How does that music make a feeling that's so specific?
There's just taps into music, isn't it? Mm.
It seems a shame that the song that's supposed to unite all us British is "God Save the Queen." And it's
a dirge,
isn't it? I mean, it's not uplifting. Well, in my opinion. It's not very uplifting, but apparently it's only something that started in the mid-19th century. Before, there was a different national anthem.
Let's not go into the national anthem. That wasn't quite what we had in mind here.
unifying.
No, but it's a false. It's a false unity in nation, isn't it?
But it gives to some. I mean, depending on how one feels about it, but it gives a real sense of belonging to a group.
Well, it gives those of privilege and close to the monarchy a way of kind of establishing their position. You know,
veneration to them.
Yeah, it's like.
If you listen to the words of the French national anthem, you're in a completely different space. I mean, that's all about the blood of the enemy soaking into the soil.
Cheeky sweets, sorry.
But
very different.
But even though just thinking about the French national anthem, it wasn't actually. Wasn't it Parisian? It was someone from Alsace.
No, Marseillaise.
But it wasn't from Marseille. Mm. It was actually from someone that lived in Alsace, so they did, in a strange way, they were quite Germanic. Mm.
Oh, it's horrible, it's very bloodthirsty.
Anyway.
But back to it, we were discussing prose, weren't we, and poetry. So prose, being our ordinary speech, was first known as pisos logos, literally pedestrian or walking logos. Logos being something I think we're going to, it's a word we're going to look into because we're doing language and meaning. So, because logos is often translated as language, but I think in the original Greek, it meant speech.
I thought it meant the word of God. Was that the logos?
Yeah, the logos was the Greek word that they.
Greek was speech?
Speech, yes. But it's not easily translated because the Greeks didn't have, at the time, as far as I know, they didn't distinguish between language and speech.
I thought it was logic.
That's good. And that logic has come from logos. That's what I mean. It's an interesting word in that nobody's quite sure what it means.
Mm.
But it's the root word for language. For us, you know, in Europe, it's quite a puzzle to work out what the Greeks really meant by it, and that's one of the puzzles that Heidegger, I think, is going to introduce us to once we get through the. I don't want to say these are preliminaries, but in a way, they're preliminaries. Just it's a background to us really getting into language. But I, th- I, I don't know if I made this clear enough at the beginning. I mean, part of the reason that we're looking into this is because we're sort of looking at this dichotomy from Maturana and Ferd and Sola of the loving human and the aggressive human. Do you know, that was a big, it was a big division, almost saying there were, it's like two species, and the book itself is a saying, well, the loving human is going to disappear unless we conserve it, we conserve that way of being. But what McGilchrist is looking at is saying, well, there's another duality here between the left and the right side of the brain, and maybe there's a parallel between them, that what Maturana and Ferd and Sola were seeing, McGilchrist is seeing in the structure of the brain. So that, I don't know if I made that clear, but that's my sort of understanding of the parallel of these two things. That's not to say that the right brain is all love and the left brain is all aggression. It's more to say that the dichotomy or the dualism is not quite so cut and dried as Maturana and Ferd and Sola are saying, as if we could be all, because I think you were feeling this, as if we could be all love and no aggression. I guess the view that McGilchrist has is that there's and this might be the view of all psychology, there's a synthesis between these two aspects that's possible, but we aren't there yet, and we're looking here at an arc of millions of years. You know, we're just a little snapshot in the development of humanity on Earth, right? And if you were to say there was a plan in it, which we can't say, right? But if you had, we tend to look into it and see, well, there has to be a purpose, otherwise what was it all about? You know, what was it, what did we go through all this for? You could say that this period of our history is the development of the left hemisphere. It's the evolutionary development of the left hemisphere. That's what we're undergoing at the moment. You can only look back on that. We need another million years. Then we could sort of say, oh yeah, that's how it was. Or is it just, we like the dinosaurs. It was a mistake, basically, the mammalian brain. We'll try again. We don't quite know how it's going to pan out, do we?
Because we don't know how we are, the same as people didn't know how they were in the 50s or even the 70s, and people, like you're saying about Benny Hill and all that.
Yes, yes.
People didn't realise, we think we know who we are, but we don't know who we are, and we won't until we're outside of where we are now.
I guess in me, I'm just talking about me, I sense that there is the possibility of such a synthesis is already available to us as individuals, not as a culture. You know, it's like the culture is stuck in a terrible duality as far as I see it. But the individual, each individual, has a capacity to get out of that, and whether the great, the trajectory of our entire civilization and life on Earth, where that's going, that's what we can't see. But it's possible to see what's one's own capacity. It depends how you read it. I mean, I would say I read that from certain moments in my life, which I would say were more real, you know. So I remain true, if you like, to the more real moments. But again, you know, it's always now. So back to prose. So it was called Walking Logos because the dancing logos of poetry was the you know, it was the language of Homer. It was how, if you're going to tell a story, you tell it in poetry, and you would probably sing it. And the whole history of the culture was sung and learned as you know, the myths and legends were songs and sagas that would be transferred through the bards, as they were called in those days. So and again, McGilchrist is saying this capacity to communicate in that way is more to do with the right hemisphere, because the right hemisphere has the bigger picture that is necessary to understand metaphor. That's why he's putting poetry onto the right hand side, because he's saying that bigger awareness of context means that you can see the connection between a word over here that obviously that doesn't necessarily connect with what you want to say, but you use it. I mean, it's very hard to think of a metaphor just off the top of my head. Metaphor? Yes? I mean, when I say it's very hard to think of a metaphor, it's because we're absolutely drowning in them.
Drowning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're drowning in them. Exactly. All of that, you would... It's almost like you can... If you want to think of the left brain, it's like you can be a computer programmer. I can imagine it. You have to then, if you're writing a computer program to understand language, you can start imagining how you try and get the computer program to figure out what you meant by drowning in that sentence. Mm. Yes, you can see what the computer's going to do. It's going to be phoning emergency services saying there's a lot of water in here. You know that people are saying they're drowning. Obviously that you see that that's where language understanding with computers breaks down, because we understand from the broad context what the metaphor means. If you're just looking at a string of words, it's not at all clear what it means. Yes?
It's interesting. This occurred to me, because even with prose, I mean, you've got fiction and you've got non-fiction. So I think fiction probably came first. So somebody was telling a story that wasn't in poem, wasn't musical, he just told it, and yet it was kind of fiction. And then you move from fiction to non-fiction. And then you start to have like references in the body of text to create this kind of thing. And it's just crazy, really, that you kind of have to have, you know, everything that you read nowadays have this kind of reference to something else to create this context. You know, when you sing a song, you don't say, "Oh, I love you, see, page 3, 5.
Yeah.
Like, "Oh, and I feel so at home with you." You know, you don't kind of sing the context. The context is kind of assumed.
Yes, mm-hmm. And there are all of those...
fiction, you constantly bombard people with...
You've always got to prove where you're coming from.
Yeah.
The evidence has always got to be there.
Yeah.
You know, where did you get that from?
Well,
okay, you know, that's that tip.
Yeah.
That
it's a need to,
yeah.
You know, like...
Huge.
Can I just clarify something?
Yes.
Are you saying that when this distinction was made between pathos, logos, and lyrical poetry, that the pathos, logos would not have contained any metaphors?
No.
What?
No, that, there wouldn't be any...
Metaphorical language, I mean, prose is replete with metaphors.
Yes,
right?
Not saying that.
Oh, right, okay, what are you saying?
I'm saying that any metaphor engages the right hemisphere.
So the
basic understanding of ordinary language is fun, and this is his conclusion. If you don't understand the context, you don't understand language, and the right hemisphere is continuously doing that for you all the time.
Yeah, I get that, but
yeah.
It's this distinction between poetry and some poetry and prose.
Yes.
And then you've got in brackets, you know, the metaphorical language of poetry. I mean, some poetry is not particularly metaphorical. To the left hemisphere language, the referential language of prose.
Yes.
I think prose is, contains a lot of metaphor, and poetry does have reference.
Yes, and McGilchrist isn't saying, I think you're taking, we've lifting him out of context there.
Right.
So he doesn't mean that, if you read his bit on metaphor, which is based on Lakoff and Johnson are the famous people for having brought metaphor to light. He's not saying that, he's definitely not saying that ordinary prose does not involve metaphor. All language is metaphor, it's solidified metaphor. So, it, first of all, it's a metaphor to think that a sound could refer to anything that isn't a sound, isn't it? Even the idea that that something could refer says, well, this thing that isn't that thing refers to that thing. It's the beginning. It's a metaphor, and the sound is a metaphor for the thing that it refers to. So all, but after a while, the connection becomes so solidified, we don't see the distinction anymore, and the word then is the thing, the table. We don't think, oh, it's a metaphor I'm using to refer to the table. The connection is become solidified, and then when I say I just got the idea off the top of my head, it was only afterwards I thought it's a metaphor, because it's become so solidified in language, you just see it immediately. So in a sense, I think you'll find if you read him in carefully, he would say that the right hemisphere is needed in the creation of a metaphor, in seeing how a metaphor is first formed, and then it gets through habitual use, it gets solidified, and then the left hemisphere can just use it as a token, if you like.
I don't know why it seems to ring quite true to me when I think about the idea of left hemisphere in prose, because when you're writing prose, there's almost like a deductive, mathematical, almost like it spills out, and then if you edit it, it's almost like a whole sort of formula of strings of words when you read prose.
Yes.
So I don't know, the idea of it being like a left hemisphere thing seems to ring quite true.
What, even in a novel?
Yeah, I don't know, when you see, like, I don't know, when you write prose, I'm seeing it from more than a creative position, like, it comes out, and if you edit it, like, it sort of ruins the whole string of words. Even when you ring, like, you see a whole paragraph of prose, and it flows so beautifully, like, it's like a sort of mathematical, just, like, phrase, I don't know, the way I see it.
You don't see that in poetry?
No, poetry's more, yeah, I see it as more sung, I guess, a little bit more, like, I don't know. This is me on poetry. Just
you have to sculpt it the same way.
No, but I find if you sculpt it, it starts to ruin, because it's like prose is like genuine thinking. Do you know what I mean? It's like a string of words that has in that moment that you can't ruin the whole.
You mean your own personal? Like,
yeah,
when I'm reading prose, and
when I'm reading prose, when I'm reading other people's prose, it has that same effect.
But then some prose is kind of released from music. Released from the need to be musical as well. There is some essence in that poetry on some level, yeah, it's beautiful and it's rhymes and it's not musical, but on a way it's kind of bound to rhythm, it's bound to rhyming, it's bound to whatever structure. But with prose you kind of you open. You're more
you're
not bound to anything.
Well,
no one will tell you all
right.
The weight of the
frame. Yeah. So
isn't it both sides?
Yeah, we've got to avoid. We tend to want to say, oh well, prose is the left, you know, poetry is the right. And he doesn't say metaphorical language of poetry is exclusively and absolutely done by the right, and that the left, it's just in brackets.
Right hemisphere language.
Yeah, you're filling in a word that says absolutely and exclusively and Noah and the other hemisphere isn't involved, and he hasn't said that.
Okay.
He's just putting emphasis on more on one side than the other. So if you in the book, and it's not, I'm not just playing with words here, it's absolutely clear that there is no distinct thing that the left hemisphere does on its own, unless you absolutely destroy the right hemisphere, in which case the left hemisphere has to start doing things the right hemisphere did anyway, to function. Do you know, you everything you do involves both hemispheres, but he's talking about the attention, the broader attention and the narrower attention that's going on simultaneously. And there's another aspect to this, which is that I mentioned at the beginning, which is that we tend to notice what's going on in the left and not the right. That our focus of attention is also associated with our focus of consciousness. So what the left is doing tends to be what we're conscious of.
And I would say that when you read poetry, you have to engage the left, because it's the best possible words in the best possible order, and every word has got, you're really focusing on each word. When you read prose, you're looking for the general impression about what the general atmosphere, the build-up, the scenario is. So I would say that reading those things are actually engaging the opposite hemispheres as the creation of those things.
Yes, well, but it's definitely, he's definitely clear about this. It's both.
All right,
there's no comprehension of the chunky wordness, chunky individual word comprehension, which you need for prose and poetry, is more on the left. The broader context, without which you can't put it together and make sense of it, or even understand that it's a bit of poetry, you know. You know, the context is everything. The context right now, you being in the class responding to what I've said. Do you know, it's all that there's a broader awareness of where we are that's in play all the time. But as soon as we focus on the individual parts, which you'll do when you're reading a piece of poetry.
Much more than...
Yeah. But then you get the... you know, the air, something like the air of like the rose petals in a dust bowl that I disturb. I wish I could quote it. Anyone know that one? Four quartets, T.S. Eliot. To what purpose? To what purpose am I disturbing the rose petals in the dust bowl of your mind? Which, you know, I mean, each word you say, well, what marvellous words, and yet, but the atmosphere that it evokes of the futility of, you know, he's just, that he was, because Eliot's brilliant about this, he tries to talk about the effect the poetry's having on you as you're reading it, and how it's like for him writing it. You get a whole other dimension in Eliot that maybe we should read some Eliot. After we've finished our singing and dancing. So, he wants to say, and there's another book I might have mentioned before, the Origins of Consciousness in the Bicameral Brain or Mind, I forget which one, the Julian James book, that's more or less is suggesting that this development of language 40 to 80,000 years ago was also the development of it was the left hemisphere coming to predominance, and it was the beginning of what we experience as self-consciousness or egoic consciousness. So there's a deeper suggestion here that all of these things are intertwined. We're not to think that the pre-linguistic culture, the Musi language people, were conscious in the way that we are, or self-conscious is the word, that they were that they were necessarily aware of being an individual in the way that we are. Now it's very hard to discern that. Julian James's book was very interesting because he tries to look back into the old Homeric legends of the Greeks, and he reckons that something happened between the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, the story of Troy and then Odysseus's journey. He thinks he sees the beginning of a kind of individual identity in Odysseus emerging, a kind of a reflective self-consciousness. Not that the people previously were unconscious, but he is suggesting that there was a different kind of consciousness that's much more akin to how people experience being schizophrenic, that the right brain actually used to talk, and it would be experienced not as me talking, but as the gods talking. That there was a time there where the hemispheres were divided in a completely different way, where the right hemisphere, if you like, was the predominant, but experienced by the left as the ancestors or the gods communicating.
So he means that for everyone, not just for property types.
No, for the whole rather undifferentiated mob of us. I mean, there's all kinds of. I mean, we used to listen to a guy called Barry Long who had his own take on this. His view was that people became self-conscious one at a time, and in a way sort of woke up, but suddenly were aware that pretty much the rest of humanity was virtually dreaming, and that it was possible for them to utterly control everyone. And these first self-conscious individuals became the legends that became the myths. They became the Dianas and the Artemises. Barry Long, he wrote a book called The Origins of Man and the Universe, where he went into this. But he's if you treat Maturana as, you know, left field, Barry's right out there, you know. You don't want to mention him if you're at a coffee break at the university, you know, that sort of thing.
Do you know him?
Yes. Well, he's dead now.
I think wasn't James trying also to explain the sudden flowering of philosophy about 2,500 years ago?
Yeah.
And he said, why did you have writing for so long before that point? But it was all kind of lists of stuff or, you know, building instructions. And then suddenly you get philosophized.
Yes, in fact, Gilchrist is going to say that the first elements of writing were tended to be, you know, just bureaucratic lists of how many oxen.
There's access to writing materials, because you'd have to like carve things in a stone or use a clay tablet, but then you wouldn't have the clay tablet if you kept all the wax, if you kept everything else. Maybe access to.
Yeah, but we have access to the ones that we have access to. The writings tend to be like fairly prosaic, and then suddenly, like, you've got the rise of Greek philosophy, you've got Confucianism, you've got, at the same time in the world, you suddenly get this great flowering of thought.
Yeah.
Yes.
In writing.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if there was a change in the availability of materials. So you make lists and things. If you didn't have lots of material to use for different things, because you need to keep those records. So if you had some material available.
I think it's time available as well, isn't it? Because, and this is something that goes back to what you said right at the beginning, that if the tension is to eat and to look for enemies, and then by the function of the left hemisphere, it's not just the eating, it's also creating the way of, you know, making sure that you're not going to be eating. Then you don't need to use your attention about being eaten so much as you would when it's half and half. So half your survival depends on eating. Half of your survival depends on looking for predators.
But no, another half of your survival depends on your family group not kicking you out into the wilderness. You know, so the right, if you like, that right brain, that empathy with that getting along with everybody else was survival too. Even once you got rid of the wolves.
Okay.
You know.
But it's almost, you
and it still is, right, for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's always some dangers as well around. But I would say, as a time, because we kind of reduce the enemies and the risk of being...
Now we're living behind a big fat wall now.
We've created the agriculture and the stuff, so then they could philosophers. They had
surplus value, according to Marx.
Saying that hunter-gathering people actually spend a hell of a lot of time just chilling out and chatting.
That's a myth there, you see. I think if we spend a little bit of time, you know, back with the hunter-gatherer culture, and then you explain to them how you get up at 7 a.m., you know, and you go to work, and you come home and you've got to write your notes up and check your emails, and then finally you have some food, and then, you know, you watch a bit of TV, and then you say, well, we've got so much leisure. You know, I think they go, what? Where? Where was that? Where was that leisure? Do you know?
It's more the hardness of, you have to be sturdier, then I think we become, in terms of the conditioning of our environments, we can get from A to B very quickly. We can work elsewhere, we can work on a computer. We've morphed into different things.
Yeah, I mean, what we'd find hard would be the complete absence of all of our options of what we could do. We just sit here on the savannah, you know, and we do today what we did yesterday, and then we do that the same the day after. But
then someone starts singing.
Yeah, they start singing. That's right. Distract us.
No,
but the point. I was wanting to make here, because in a way, a lot of this looking back, you know, it's there's nothing fixed. We can't say that it happened on this date. But at some point or other, I think that we definitely got the higher apes and the chimpanzees, and we've got us, and stuff happened in between. And we're just reconstructing something of the story here. And we're saying, right, so it looks like we would have started to sing, and the singing was started to organise ourselves in more sophisticated ways. And our behaviours were more conducive to survival, and we selected for people who could communicate. Things went on. There's a certain point here which Maturana didn't talk about, where something like self-consciousness dawned. Self-consciousness being, not only am I here, but I notice I'm here. I know I'm here. Only when that happens can you reflect then and think about yourself, and you can become a figure in your thinking about yourself. But thinking about yourself isn't self-consciousness. There's a primal, pure state of just being present and knowing you're here. We're back to the foundations of consciousness. There's a certain essence of human consciousness that knows there is consciousness here, that distinguishes us from the cat. Now, I don't know how to put it into language any different to that. If you look into a cat's eyes and you look into a human being's eyes, just try it. Human being, there's a human being here. There's a cat here. There's a difference. What's the difference? I'm calling it self-consciousness. I'm saying that it dawned on the human race at a certain point. And Julian James's book is an attempt to say, and it weren't that long ago. Maybe it was before that. Maybe we needed to be self-conscious even to write, because he's putting it later than that. But at a certain point, self-consciousness dawned, and it seems to be that... it's a left hemisphere.
Isn't it in our own ontogeny? I mean, don't you remember suddenly realising you were...
Oh, yeah, well, there you go. That, the same old, it develops as you...
We've all been through that.
Well, I'm not sure... when I look at we've got to have the cat, the baby, and the human. When I look into... I've looked into a few babies' eyes, and I see somebody looking back at me. I don't know who's had a baby. Is the newborn looking at you like a cat? Is there a moment where?
No, but they're there from the first second.
They can't see.
But they're still there. They're still.
What?
Well,
at the beginning, they're not a bit. So their eyes are like.
Yeah, but they're still so them. It's like my younger son, he smiled an hour after being born. I'm like,
blind
he's
babies
like,
smile.
You don't have to.
But you know what I'm.
No,
the
other two
are not communicating like that. It's innate.
But you know what I'm trying to say is there's something in the look. You forget the language or the behaviour or whatever. There's something in the there's a self consciousness in the human beings that is different to the consciousness in an animal.
It's something about seeing, I think a human sees themselves in reference of another rather than, so the baby is making sense of the world and it's sort of kind of learning who they are in reference to their mother, to other. And I think with animals, that's less so. They're like, okay, cool, I'm here and there's the other people. And it's, I don't know, it's
I think for me,
that's what I see very different. Mm-hmm. An animal doesn't care who they are in reference to another because,
Well, no, because I mean, I'm trying to put it one way or another. You've got to know that I'm here first, and then as soon as I know I'm here, then you're immediately there. The two come together. There's an immediate. It's just a consciousness of being conscious.
I think the difference for me was the difference between being the sensations and somebody having the sensations.
See, I almost feel that the moment of reflection, when you reflect back on yourself, comes after.
No, it's pre-linguistic.
Yeah.
It's pre-linguistic, but I remember. I do remember a time, vaguely, I remember a time when it was just pain or pleasure. That was it. I was that pain or pleasure. And then there was a time when I was having, Maria was having the pain or pleasure. I got a sense of it happening to me. There was a distinct difference between being those sensations and having them. And there was a split. Change.
Yes.
I've got vague recollections of that.
See, but I'm reminded of Barry's, when Barry wrote about this in the Origins book, Barry Long, he was just being mythical. He's like a prophet, really. He said there was a moment, and he doesn't give a date, when the first human being saw the sunrise. And for the first time, it's a myth, right, in a way, but I understood what he meant. Up until then, nobody had seen the sunrise. For him, it was symbolically significant that it was actually the sunlight that penetrated
the veil
of a pateness, which is, you remember we were talking about the ring of inhibition. That the animals are caught in an instinctual world, and their relation to the world is such that the world has to trigger their instinctual response. So they experience an instinctual relation to the world, where they don't see the world. Language is no good for this. I'm trying to indicate something that there's a if your entire response to what's happening is determined by a structure of instincts that you still learnt them, right? It's not that they were just written down. They come from your experience, but you're a kind of like the behaviourist. You're a stimulus response entity. Where if a certain instinct gets triggered, then your behaviour is as such. You don't see things directly. You only see them in relation to what they trigger in you. And that self-consciousness isn't just I'm who I am. It's you see. We live in it, right? We've all made it. I guess what we've all made it. We all see the table. We don't realize it because we live it every second. But there was a that Barry communicated to me that there was a that it wasn't always such. There's a pre self-conscious state that as human beings we were once in, and we had to emerge from it, and we probably emerged from it bit by bit, and that we've reached a place now where pretty much everyone, not everyone, but pretty much everyone, is we're on this. You know, we think, oh, Einstein is really brilliant, you know, and we think there's grades of difference between our consciousness, but if you like. Maybe there's that much greater difference, but we've all made it across this terribly important threshold.
Don't we all like weave in and out though? I mean, sometimes you might be feeling very aware, and other times you might be hammered, or you might just be, you know, lost, just trundling along doing some boring chore, and you're not really there.
Oh yes, oh yes, and I mean that's it, isn't it? And you can get. Almost possessed, also you can have a psychic possession where you virtually lost consciousness and you are in a grip of an instinctual drive. You know, it's possible for us to fall back into something like that. You know, I'm sure a lot of crime is committed in that state. You know, it's not that we're out of it all the time, but there's a whole difference between a being that can be out of it and you know has that capacity, and one that doesn't. Because I'm only emphasizing this because Heidegger's going to go on about this. He's not in these terms exactly, but he's going to say that at the core, language is at the core of what distinguishes us as the beings that we are. It's not just something we acquired, but our use of language is an expression of a different mode of being that we have, where we see the sun.
We used to have a dog. My parents' house is on the cliff, and it overlooks the sea. And the dog used to sit there for hours, just watching the sea, thinking her own thoughts.
Yes.
I mean, there's no. What other purpose would she have to sit and watch the sea?
Yes. Well, all I can say again is, I was at the cafe the other day, right? Just to have a really close, get a dog, make eye contact, and see what, because I it's clear to me I'm not looking at another human being there, not at all.
No, not another human.
And I can almost in what Barry said about the veil of opaqueness, I can sort of see it. It's a psychic thing. I can see that there's something, if you like, if it wasn't there, you can almost feel it could fall and the dog would suddenly see you.
Would it have been a lonely place for that first person, though?
I think it would have been, oh my God.
So then you got to
yes. Oh my God. This is amazing. This is so sparkly. It would be like LSD plus. Plus plus.
What, if you saw the dog, or the dog saw
you? No. The suddenly seeing that here I am in the world. Here's nature.
I would say that people are just automatically in like a massive trip without, you know, we've narrowed it down and it's become more mundane and dull, and we don't see how wonderful everything is.
Well, that's the case. But I think the first human that this dawned on would have. I don't think it would have been fear. I think it would have been wonder.
They didn't live in a council estate, you know.
Yeah, I didn't live in a council estate.
They probably witnessed the sunrise in a nicer setting. You know?
That's why the tomb and all of that is so important, isn't it? Because it does lift your way so that you're not necessarily confronted by the concrete and all the rest of it. Same with here. I mean, we're not just seeing, we're not just... We're somehow transported away from the construction site that we're actually on.
Yeah, but right now, and maybe for a big percentage of your life, you are viewing this as your what you view. Right now, For the last 2 hours, we were sitting here and we were sitting in this prefab, in this kind of thing. And, you know, if you think that that doesn't influence your consciousness, I'm sure that it does.
Yeah, no.
Ongoingly, you know, long term for all of us. Huh?
It's warm.
Mm. Yes, it is warm.
No, the, but the main thing...
The
main thing, if I could point out, the main thing for us here in this room is each other.
Yeah.
And you can be in the most beautiful, wonderful place, but if you're depressed, you can't take any of it in. It's just there. And it makes you more depressed because you know that it's beautiful, but you still can't.
To be fair, because I think it's like what you view in your eyes, it's like the food that you eat. If you eat rubbish food, you'll be sick. If you have rubbish experiences, you'll be sick. If you have, and what I'm saying is an experience. Unfortunately, we cultivate. Because it's not easy to knock down the whole thing or redesign the whole city so that there will be an environment that actually lifts us up.
Yes, everything.
You know,
yeah.
Unfortunately, they're not lifting
us up.
And the air quality that we breathe is also not lifting us up. So, you know, yes,
but
it's
I just
warm,
say it because...
And we have each other, which is great. I'm loving it, but it's like, you know...
So just a quickie, just in...
As soon as you find out that you haven't got much longer to live... That may change.
Yeah.
Okay.
In
a way that you kind of.
I think the fact that you won't have much longer to live,
yeah.
for whatever reason, and we'll all go through this at some point. There's no doubt that we're all in this room going to go through this.
Mm-hmm.
Then things might change.
Mm-hmm. You stop seeing the rubbish outside, and you start seeing. The faces of the people on the wall, and that same celebration of learning.
I mean,
there's beautiful stuff about unions outside.
That's not for everyone, because of course you can feel quite depressed at the fact maybe I've got cancer and I'm going to have to go through treatment and all the rest of it, or anything. I don't want to just say cancer but I think. That's my experience, and this is with close friends as well as patients. In my own experience of it having cancer, is things start to change. There's things take on a different beauty. You know, you might be on a bus in the middle of Brighton, but there's a beauty in the person sitting next to you, or.
Yes, people.
There's the sky, there's the seagull, it's just like, oh, thank God I'm alive. You know? Thank God I'm still here. You know?
I mean, I had a, you know, it was...
And I agree, but at the same time, things start to scintillate and the beautiful path you walked down that you loved and enjoyed... suddenly starts glistening because you've just been told you've got cancer. Mm. And you're like, wow, it's just like there's some other thing happening here, and that path was just like, we like to walk down that path, but then you walk down that path and you've just had that news, and sometimes it just changes it. Maybe it won't change it for you, I don't know, maybe we're all different and we could feel quite depressed.
I think other things become more important, don't they?
But they do. People, and you can read, there's 50 million autobiographies nowadays from people who've been through it all, and now with a lot of healthcare professionals all writing about it, it's time and time again, people write, it's those things. We're reading a book at the moment, it's written by somebody, who's looking back on, who's dying, and their son, is a book to their son. So I think we're funny things, aren't we? Because we do get to this familiarity.
I've slammed back into the slides. I've got this feeling there's going to be a meeting at 2, isn't there? I've got a bad feeling that we're going to be kicked out in 20 minutes.
Oh, is there a 2 o'clock meeting?
Yeah. Yes, and that clock's wrong already. That's
but
thing
I
that,
thought concessions are only until 2 anyway. I mean, that's what it said on the time.
Oh, I know. But we have to extend them before the people who came late so that they get their four hours. good. So, hands and language. All right, there's a story now that McGilchrist is going to say that's to do with the right hand and the left hemisphere and the grasping and the tool-making story, right? Remember the tool-making story? That old story that says, you know, language and tools and man with a capital M, that civilization came about as soon as we started making sharp axes and spears. And this is all to do with the right hand and the grasping. And he's going to point out that the language areas in the brain are very close to the areas that control the grasping reflex in the hand. And that there's something about the left hemisphere's attention that is a grasping, particularizing attention that's very akin to the grasping, particularizing way that the hand can only deal with one thing at a time. It only has a limited, you know, field of action. You can't do two things at once. And it's always looking at something, involved with something. It may be involved in the background with the bigger picture of what's going on, but at any moment, you know, with Heidegger's hammering, did we cover Heidegger's hammering? Maria, does that ring any bells?
Well, not on this call.
No, but previously, yes. Extensively. Yes. So there's a whole he wants to draw a parallel between the way the hand does one thing at a time and the two hands put things together with the way that individual words, in a way, they grasp things. They refer, instead of the hand picking something, a word picks something. But without the hand actually having to get there, I can say the cup. Do you see, if I didn't have language, I'd have to point, or I'd actually have to pick it up. But language enables me to talk about the sink in the other room. You see, it's a certain level where you can see it's like this hand that can suddenly shoot straight across the planet to New York. Do you know the word? That's what the word, it refers like the hand. You see, suddenly the hand has this capacity to grasp anything that it can talk about. And it's no longer a hand, of course, but you see we're looking back into the bodily embodied roots of language. And the particular, you know, when we were singing to each other, we weren't grasping at little things. We were expressing something about how we were feeling. We might be singing about something that we might do, but we weren't picking things out. Do you see there's a picking things out that comes out of the hand that's related to this, what McGilchrist is thinking is the left brain capacity of language. And it's not saying that the left brain is in charge of verbal symbolic language, because it's if you like, the right brain understands the entire sentence and the context within which the sentence appears, which is in the context of this lecture, which is in the context of the day, which is in the context of its coming up, and there's going to be, do you know, that all of that, we're all scanning that, aren't we? It's all happening within that, with that bigger awareness. But we get a certain fixity from our naming of things and our use of words as forms of reference. You know, it used to be considered a magical power if you knew the name of something that you had, that you in some way you controlled it. And next week, I think, or the week after, we'll be looking into that there is some primal experience of language where we're not aware of, because we're in it all the time, where we do make something appear by naming it. We don't think so because we don't literally say it's a cup, but somewhere, as soon as we look at a cup, language is in play for us. Because we speak about language in this class as if we're, you know, we keep, can't help it, as if we're up here and language is down there and we know what it is. But the only way we'd really be able to know what it is to have it completely wiped away. Then you wouldn't know what it was because you'd have no language, right? And then suddenly to get it back, I think then you'd say, ah, so that's language. But we have to approach it around the corner, really. So we're looking at this capacity of language to pick out and name things. But I think when we look into language later in the course, there's a kind of a model there as if language is just picking out something that was already there somehow. We don't see our ability to name something actually brings it into presence for us. I mean, if we get to the bottom of that, we'll be getting to the bottom of the course itself, because the bottom of the course is really about this power of language to manifest the world to us.
So is recall associated with any particular hemisphere?
It's another Nicolette looks it up in the
Is what?
I think it's got to involve both.
And I often have to then describe all around the edges of the word that I can't recall. So that's a different part of me doing that than the part that's meant to be able to grab the word.
While Nicolette looks that up, I'm going to mention the musical language was an I-thou language. It was to do with us together and what we're going to do, what we are doing, how we're feeling about it. It was a communication between us. Once language becomes symbolic in this way, and you've got words that refer, it starts to become an I-it. You start to have things. If you follow that, our music language, if you like, is entirely a relational experience that involves other people, but it still is, but now our referential symbolic language enables us to, could you sort of see it as a map metaphorically, we're pointing everywhere, right? My language is firing off, and in a way we're looking in somewhere in the intellect here, aren't we? Do you know what I'm talking about? I'm talking about ideas. Where are they? Well, metaphorically, we can picture them. There's a sort of an intellect we're looking at here. And I'm referring all, you know, it's firing all over the place.
There's something on recall memory.
But do you see, you're listening to me, but in a way we're looking at something else. Do you know, if we were back down and I was just singing to you, we'd be much more immediately. I mean, it's odd, isn't it? Even as I speak about it, I start feeling, oh yeah, well, we're even speaking of it, we're much more just relating in an I-thou way.
Yeah.
But then I start talking about language, you can feel it recedes, and we start to looking at things that we're referring to over there. This is the beginning of, I mean, I remember I used to do a historical story, if you like, of the development of Western culture, where language is a form of exercise of power, of course, because it enables you to specify with extreme precision the way things are that go beyond pointing. You can specify how things are anywhere that you know of, that somebody else with you also knows of. That means you can refer to the whole wide earth now, and not only that, the solar system. Do you see the reach of language? And we can refer to it with absolute clarity and specificity in a way that you couldn't sing it. And it's only once you have that you could start to organise something like a civilization. And then, of course, he's going to say, and then you can write it down. And that means you're not limited anymore to the amount of information you can hold in one brain. It becomes potentially not infinite, but it becomes massively expanded, and then you get, you know, the internet's the next thing.
And then you kind of lose the wood for the trees, don't you? That's unless you maintain the ability to see the wood
Yes.
During this kind of
yes.
process of becoming more and more specific and better and better and better at describing.
Bingo, bingo. The Shallows. So there's a book about Google and the internet. That's what's happened, right? There's just this great lake. It's about that deep of everything that you can know on the internet, and there's no coherent understanding that is able to put it into a structure where it makes sense anymore. Whereas for a long time, people lived in cultures and societies where there was a lot of information, but there was it hadn't overflowed the boundaries of the structure of the way that culture understands the being of the world. But the beginning of having precise referential language is the beginning. Writing expands it, and then printing, right? Because just to begin with, writing has to be right. I make a book. Now I have to copy it. You know, we've got 3 copies now in the Library of Alexandria of Plato. You know, and that's it for the world. You want to read Plato? You go to Alexandria. You see where we are now. Amazing at one level, and then utterly kind of swamping, to use a metaphor, at another. You know, you become. Just this little non-entity, don't you, in relation to it, your little mind and what it knows in comparison to all it could know. But what I remember, written instructions, you can't run an empire without written instructions. That's why I've got Rome up on there. And what I remembered is you can't run a global empire without the telegraph. You know, that was the beginning of the beginning of global capitalism was the telegraph. You couldn't control London. Westminster could not control Australia if it was a 2-month trip and then a 2-month back. Do this on the boat, 2 months to Sydney. I don't think I will. Empire was, you basically, that's exactly right. What the East India Company was a kind of a separate power unto its own right, completely out of touch. It wasn't an empire. That wasn't empire. Empire is when the whole thing is unified under the control of a central government, and that only becomes possible when you've got the communications infrastructure to do it. So global capitalism, you can't trade like that. You can't have a stock exchange that has to wait 4 months to hear how your investment's gone, right? You know that they're slicing it down now to... It's not just a tenth of a second. You know, you can make... You lose millions in a nanosecond. So the speed of communication it facilitates... You can't control anything unless you've got the communication channel, and the communication channel relies on language and its dissemination and its ability to... And we were talking earlier about left-brain language, which, saying that there isn't really any left-brain language, but McGilchrist does indicate that at some level, one example of left-brain language is the information that computers exchange with each other, which are just bare instructions. Is it?
It's nearly time.
Yeah, yeah. I thought there would. Yeah.
Because this one is not correct. If you're looking at that,
I know it's 10:02. We finish.
Yes.
Yep.
Well, it's 2 minutes to now.
Is it?
So it's nearly 2.
All right. In fact, I think that means we.
Yeah, you might
we have. Finish. Metaphor, we talked about metaphor, a lot of gesture in music, a lot of imitation. We learn to speak through imitation, is the gist of that, not through copy. Imitation is an empathetic inhabiting of the other.
Is it
Slightly... Yeah, I'll put them up. Yeah, there's. I better admit defeat. I'll admit defeat. I'll stop the recording.